From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Alan Arkin plays a geriatric guzzler in the new film Little Miss Sunshine. On today's Fresh Air, Arkin tells us about some of his earliest acting roles, including the 1960s classic The Russians Are Coming. Also, comedian and actor Damon Wayans joins us. An early HBO stand-up special has just been released on DVD, and he's starring in the upcoming Showtime series The Underground. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Alan Arkin has been appearing in movies for 50 years. Among his films are The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Catch-22, The 7% Solution, The In-Laws, and Glengarry Glen Ross. As a director, he did the stage and screen versions of Jules Pfeiffer's Little Murders. Arkin is now appearing with Greg Kinnear and Toni Collette in the film Little Miss Sunshine. He plays a grandfather who's just been kicked out of the retirement home he adored for snorting heroin. Now he's living with his son's family. In this scene, Arkin is reassuring his 7-year-old granddaughter, Olive, whom he's been training for a beauty pageant.
Grandpa?
Yeah?
Am I pretty?
Olive? You are the most beautiful girl in the whole world.
And you're just saying that?
No, I'm not. I'm madly in love with you. And it's not because of your brains or your personality. It's because you're beautiful, inside and out.
Grandpa?
What?
I don't want to be a loser.
You're not a loser. Where'd you get the idea you're a loser?
Because Dad hates losers.
Whoa. Back up a minute. You know what a loser is? A real loser is somebody that's so afraid of not winning, they don't even try. Now, you're trying, right?
Yeah.
Well, then you're not a loser. We're going to have fun tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
We can tell them all to go to hell. Good night, sweetie. I love you.
Alan Arkin from the film Little Miss Sunshine. Arkin spoke with Terry in 1989. He told her that as an actor, he liked the challenge of trying to get beyond the limitations of his abilities and personality.
For me, one of the goals is to be something more than what I am. And no matter how far afield I think I'm going, in retrospect, I look back and all I see is me. Even no matter how many hats I change, no matter how many limps I affect or speech patterns I change, I almost invariably only see me. There have been a couple of times when I feel like I've transcended my own identity. And those were really enormously exciting times for me.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with seeing yourself in a role, though?
That's not the idea of doing it. I think originally that is. People want to perform initially because they want to be seen. Hey, look at me. Look what I'm doing. But then once in a while you reach something. I've been lecturing on this for the past year or two, on this very idea. You reach something in. And it's not just performing, it's almost any field, which is a kind of a epiphany where you're no longer there. And I achieved that for the first time when I was about 19 or 20, and when I had been studying acting fervently. And I wasn't on stage for about 20 minutes. I disappeared. And it's as if I was watching myself play the character, and it was the most exhilarating thing I'd ever experienced up until that time. And for the next 20 years or so, I became a junkie to that experience. Athletes have that experience. They have a term for it now. It's called being in the zone. When they do things they can't do, when they run faster than they can run, when they're impossible to catch on a football field, when they can hit a ball faster and harder than they've ever been done before in tennis. And it comes from really honing down your craft and letting yourself completely go. And then this thing takes over. And once you've experienced that, nothing else will satisfy you anymore. And once you've had that feeling, you can see in looking back at it that you've had this feeling. I mean, like in the performances that I've done where I've been, in quotes, in the zone, I can see that. I can see that I've literally disappeared and the character is there playing me. And once having had that feeling, you don't settle for anything else anymore.
Do you think that the impulse to act comes in part from wanting to get out of yourself, transcend yourself?
Oh, yeah, I think for a lot of people. I don't think they phrase it that poetically initially. I think it a lot of times comes out of a kind of self-loathing that a lot of people aren't really aware of at the time, wanting to be any. It certainly was in me, and I see it in the work of a lot of other people, too, a desire to be anybody else but who you are. It also can come out of a kind of a childish thing of of imitating other people, wanting to be, you know, seeing your father and imitating him, seeing other people around that look interesting, as if they have interesting attributes you want to adopt and affect. It's, I think that's another way of.
Well, who are those people around you who you who had mannerisms that you adapted when you were young and really impressionable?
It was endless. I used to imitate people on the street. I used to imitate actors that I saw. I used to imitate family members. I used to watch people's behavior in terms of how affected I was from an acting standpoint. So real life became fodder for acting for me, which I think helped my acting, but didn't do my life any good particularly.
So even Thanksgiving dinner was, you'd be there watching how everybody was behaving?
Yeah, how did this person eat? Why am I moved when somebody says something in that way? And why can somebody else say almost the same thing and I'm not moved by them? It doesn't affect me. I was really caught up in that from a very early age on, from the age of 6, 7, 8.
When you were growing up, was there anyone in your family or in your neighborhood who was theatrical in the way they lived their life? I don't mean that they were necessarily on the stage, but they had this sense of the theater of life.
Yeah, oh, very much so. There was a guy named Sam Kennedy who was the husband of my mother's best friend, who was the most flamboyant character I'd ever met. He was right out of Sean O'Casey. He wore black turtleneck sweaters, woolen ones, without any underwear underneath, and jeans in days when nobody was doing things like that, in the 40s and late 30s. And he was about 6'4 and had a mustache and was a merchant seaman and a sculptor and a guitarist and drank like a fish. And he was the most flamboyant person I think I'd ever met. And
you like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was very organic. There was nothing artificial about it. It came right from the heart of him.
And any really colorful speakers?
Speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my father was always very good verbally, and my grandfather was made speeches for the Masons, so he was very literate. I have a vivid memory of him reading a speech, tears streaming down his face, to a plumber who was, the two of them were in the bathroom, and the plumber, all you could see was his feet sticking out from under the bathtub. He was paying absolutely no attention to my grandfather. And there he was reading this passionate speech with tears streaming down his face.
So here you were with all of this interest in theater. And when you got, I think it was when you got out of college in around 1956, you were part of the pop folk group, the Terriers.
Yeah.
And they had a hit that made it onto the charts, actually, of the Banana Boat song and what, Cindy O' Cindy?
Yeah.
It almost seems like you were miscast in that group.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I felt so myself. I ended up after about 2 years being on stage at the Olympia Theater in Paris to an audience of about 3,000. We were singing our hearts out, and I looked down at myself, and there I was in black satin pants and a sport shirt open to my navel practically, and I said, "Who am I? What am I doing here?" And I quit that night and went back to what I wanted to do, which was be connected with film and theater.
How did you get into the detour of folk music to begin with?
Well, I had gotten out of college, and I had gotten married and had a small child at the age of 22, and I needed something to do to just get us going. And there was this group that started, and I thought it would only take up my weekends periodically, and we'd make a little spare change to just survive on it. And within 3 months, we had an enormous hit on our hands, and so we traveled around the world with that for about 2 years, and it just seemed to me that it was the logical thing to do at the time. And I also thought, in my naive fashion, that would be an entree into film and theater, which it wasn't.
Well, I think one of your entrees into film and theater was Chicago's Second
City
group.
Yeah, it was my entree into everything. Mm-hmm. I feel like I got born there.
Second City was an improvisational theater and comedy group. Were you surprised that you were good at improvisation?
Very, yeah. I had no idea I had any abilities in that area at all. In fact, it took me months to be funny. I would work out with David Shepherd and the group, and I wasn't funny. Nothing I did was funny. And then finally, I hit upon one character that was funny. So I just played that character for a long time. No matter what I did as that character, people laughed. And so I said, well, I'll stick with that.
What was the character?
I don't remember. It was one ethnic type or another. I don't remember exactly who it was. But then I started adding to that character. I started adding other characters to that character, and I ended up with a library of characters that I played, that each of which I felt were very far from what I was as a person, only to find out 10 years later and looking back that they were all exactly like me, every one of them.
Who were some of the characters?
Well, I had a Puerto Rican kid, a sensitive Puerto Rican kid who considered himself unable to do anything in society, played guitar. I had an ancient Jewish pretzel vendor who was modeled after my grandfather. I had an Italian laborer. I had a Chinese chef. That was the first four, I think. But I tried to use them in everything. I tried to squeeze them in every conceivable kind of place because they were the only things I felt comfortable with for a long time.
So at what point were you ready to leave those characters aside and play comedy yourself?
Well, it was a long time. It really started when Mike Nichols cast me as Yossarian in Catch 22, and I kept looking at the character and looking at it, and I said, well, I finally asked him, who do I play him like? Who is he? Who should I model him after? He said, he's you. Mike said, he's you. And I thought to myself, what does he mean, me? There isn't any me. There's going to be a blank on the screen if I just do me. Nobody will show up. And he finally convinced me that I just had to be myself in that situation, and I had great trepidation about it. I didn't know how to do that. But I tried it, and I went to the dailies for a week or two with a lot of anxiety, thinking that there was going to be a blank hole in the screen where I was. And to my surprise, and finally I had to admit delight, there was somebody there. And I said, hey, there is a me. And I guess in most ways, that was a real transition for me, in seeing that I had an existence, that I did have some weight as myself, and that I could afford to let go of a lot of the places that I was hiding under.
Alan Arkin speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1989 interview with Alan Arkin. He's currently appearing in the new film, Little Miss Sunshine.
Let's talk a little bit about your first feature film, The Russians Are Coming. Earlier you said that when you looked back on this role, you didn't feel like you saw yourself, you saw the character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All to keep in calm, please.
Yes.
I repeat, no harm is coming. All now, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey, just take it easy now. Pete, boy, don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions, very quickly, please. So that there is no necessity whatsoever, so that there is no necessity whatsoever why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds, and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set, and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly, and there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin, let's jump ahead to 1985, to your role in the movie Joshua Then and Now. And you starred along with James Woods in this movie. You played James Woods' father, a small-time Jewish gangster and bootlegger. And I want to play an excerpt from a flashback scene in which you're in a gym with your young son and you're teaching him about the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What do we got here? Quote, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Unquote. Yeah, you see, there was a lot of contenders in those days. Other gods, mainly no account idols, bums of the month, until our God, Jehovah, came in and took the title outright and made a covenant with our people.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's... thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal?
Yeah, right, well, you know, there's Ten Commandments. It's like an exam, right? I figure you get 8 out of 10 right. You're pretty much at the top of the class, aren't you?
Was there anyone you knew in life that you could pattern this character
Not on? A soul. No, nobody I knew. I loved that character. The minute I read the script, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with him. And that was it. I told Ted Kotcheff, the director, who was wonderful to work with, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, go ahead. That sounds good. And that's what I did. I worked out a lot. I got myself in pretty good shape for it, in scenes they never ended up using. So I got into good shape for nothing. For nothing.
What a waste of time.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I have read about you that in the late 60s or early 70s that you started yoga and also found someone who was something of a guru figure for you.
Mm-hmm.
What brought about that change?
What brought about the change was 7 years of analysis in which I worked very hard and which I feel like I really needed. I was very unhappy. And I came to a point where I was coming to the end of my analysis by both my doctor's recognition and my own and feeling like I'd passed the course and having him say akin to, I never promised you a rose garden. And I found myself getting furious at that idea. Because I saw that there were people that had rose gardens, and I wanted one. And if analysis wasn't going to do it for me, particularly since I had worked very, very hard at it and had accomplished a lot of what my doctor felt was to be accomplished from it, I felt like I had to look elsewhere. And I started working with somebody who turned out, who I knew immediately was the best person I had ever met. He was the wisest and kindest person I'd ever met. And initially, I didn't know he was a yogi. He was my stand-in on a film, on Poppy. And
he was playing an extra or something?
He was my stand-in, which is not a terribly exalted job, mm-hmm. as everybody knows. And after about 3.5 weeks, I could sense very clearly that he was the center of the entire film. And it annoyed me. So I said, here I am. I have everything. I'm the star. I got 10 times as much money as he's got. I got more attention. And he's the center of this thing. It's not right. So I tried to find out who and what he was, and he finally revealed the fact that he was a guru. Has got a terribly convoluted connotations this day. We've twisted around and almost destroyed the meaning of that word. Everybody who knows something is now called a guru, which is not what the word means by any stretch of the imagination. It means slayer of darkness, which is ultimately what analysis tries to do and doesn't do. It knocks off a piece of it, but it doesn't get the whole thing. And a great spiritual teacher knocks off your darkness, which is the thing that is keeping you from functioning fully and wholly and completely and lovingly.
Can I relate this back to acting and ask you if it's changed the way you act or changed how much you act or the kinds of roles you take?
Yeah, to a degree. It depends on how much money I've got in the bank, in part. I mean,
sure.
If I'm feeling pretty flush, then I feel more comfortable in turning down things that I don't want to do. But if I'm behind a payment on the house, then I got to be a little bit more generous in my assessment of something. But yeah, I don't want to play horrible people anymore. I don't want to. It's no fun. There was a time when I had so little sense of myself that getting out of my skin and being anybody else was a sigh of relief. But I kind of like myself now a lot of the times, and I don't see any real necessity or value in playing people that I find abhorrent anymore. That's number one. And number two, I like to think if I possibly can be in situations like it, I want my work to be connected with things that somehow serve people in some way.
Well, Ellen Arkin, I thank you so much for talking.
Thank you. You're wonderful to talk to.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed this very much.
You're very easy.
Ellen Arkin speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. He's currently appearing in the new film Little Miss Sunshine. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Damon Wayans. His 1990 HBO stand-up special has just been released on DVD, and he stars in the upcoming Showtime series, The Underground. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. A terrific comedy performance by actor and comedian Damon Wayans from 1990 can now be seen again with the DVD release of Damon Wayans' The Last Stand, originally broadcast on HBO.
But I had fun. I had a great childhood, man. Growing up, even though we was crazy poor, we was like P.O. We couldn't even afford O.R. That's how poor we were. Just poor folk, you know? So he had like 10 kids, you know, and just my father worked. He was the breadwinner, you know. I remember nights we didn't eat. We had sleep for dinner, you know.
The Wayans family wasn't just large, it was talented. Besides Damon, the performing Wayans include his brothers Keenan Ivory, Marlon, and Sean. Damon Wayans first became known doing sketch comedy on the TV series In Living Color. He was later a featured performer on Saturday Night Live and starred in the ABC sitcom My Wife and Kids. His films include Mo Money, Blank Man, Celtic Pride, and Bamboozled. He'll also star in the upcoming Showtime series The Underground, which he'll direct and co-write. Wayans says the show will allow him to cut loose the way he did on In Living Color. Terry spoke to Damon Wayans in 1999 when his book Bootleg had just come out. He started with a reading from the book.
Mo Money. I found out one of my partners, Larry, is in jail now. He got 25 years for something he didn't do. He didn't run fast enough. I always knew this brother was going to jail because he was one of them dudes that wanted to make it in life, but he wanted to get over. He was a con artist, always had a plan. I called him the street businessman. I saw him when he got out of jail the last time. He's like, "What up, D? Yo, it's good to see you, man. I heard you was out there in California, man. You're doing comedy now, right? You funny? Go ahead, say something funny. Oh, man, you need an audience and whatnot and lights. Yeah. Look, you keep doing it, man. You about to be like the next Bugs Bunny or something. Yeah, but I ain't got time for no Three Stooges-type silliness. I'm trying to get me some income coming in. Word. Yo, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get me a full-time job at McDonald's. Then I'm going to work my way up to manager. Then I'm going to let my boys come rob the place. More money. See, I take that stolen money and I throw it in the bank. I won't touch that. I step off, you know, let interest handle that, you know. And it'll be like, boom, more money. See, I'm going to do this like every other day so they don't catch on. Because I don't want to go to McJail or nothing, you know. I'll be in that cell with the Hamburglar. He be bugging me out with that head, you know. Yo, and then clock this. I'm going to let my lady forge checks, right? Because she works in the bank. And then I'm going to let her prostitute on the side. You know, just in case the bank thing don't work out, she got something to fall back on. Now, this is only part-time, see, because, yo, I can't have no full-time hoe living in my house. I'm just that type of dude. See, then dig this. I'm going to adopt me a kid, one of them little foster kids, right? Because they pay you to take their ass, right? And I'm going to let him sell joints in school. More money. See, this is good for the kid, too, because it teaches him responsibility, right? Because if he messes my money, I'm going to hurt him. Now, I figure every day before he goes to school, I throw 100 lunch joints up in his lunchbox. Get him one of them Fred Flintstone lunchboxes, you know, because kids, they need that type of thing, you know? And then I send him out the door. Boom, go make that money, son. Now, if he get busted, I come to school, play the father role. Yo, what's up, teacher? No, tell me what happened. I don't want to know your name. I don't want to shake your hand. I just want the facts. Forget that. Forget all that, you know, parental stuff. Now tell me, what was my little white son doing? Then I play all surprised and be like, oh, snap, he was doing what? Ooh, surprise. And then since this is a teacher, right, I start throwing big words on him. I'd be like, circumcise me. No, flatulate the information because the whole constipation got my scrotum detached. No. Let me shed my foreskin on the issue. You retain your liquors while I masturbate my embryonic fluids. So this whole thing is supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. See, now when the teachers see how smart I am, they'll probably put me in charge of the PTA. Then I start selling crack to the parents. More money.
Damon Wayans, you break me up. That is so great. Now, that's really comes out of a sketch that you did on In Living Color. And then there was the Mo Money movie. Tell me how you first came up with the idea of that character and the Mo Money idea.
That was actually a friend of mine named Larry. He's actually no longer with us. He was actually this guy who always had this master plan, how he was going to make money and, you know, and get over in life. And I found him very funny.
What were his real schemes? Were they what you were saying?
He was selling drugs out his mother's house. And he actually died because they came to kill his mother. And he said, kill me first. And they did.
Gee. How did you know him?
I grew up with him. He was my my buddy. We used to hang out and get into trouble together.
Did your parents worry that you were going to head in this direction if you kept hanging out with that kind of crowd?
All the time. My mother would tell me, you need to be more like Keenan. Because Keenan was like the guy who didn't get in any trouble ever. He always was a straight A student, and you know the only thing he did was wear kung fu shoes in the winter. You know, that was that was his only you know, vice, was he was into karate.
Can I ask you about another character you did on In Living Color that was really great? Anton, the homeless person. Tell me how you came up with that particular person. And I know, I know, walking along the street, I would often think of you.
Anton was actually a combination of my Uncle Gene, who was my father's brother, who was on heroin. And we couldn't do heroin on In Living Color, so we made it alcohol.
Why couldn't you do heroin?
I don't know. I guess, you know, they didn't want to. It was that whole drug. You know, there was a time, like, when on Saturday Night Live, they could do cocaine, you know, and actually smoke a joint. You can't do that anymore on television. He was also a combination of my uncle and this guy who used to date my sister named Anton, who is also dead. he died in jail. But he was this guy. He used to speedball. And the whole character came from him coming over my house and trying to impress my mother. And he looked at her behind and said, "You know, now I see where Dee get her big ass from."
Actually, you have a whole sketch about this guy in your book, Bootleg.
Yeah, yeah. That's where, and I just thought that was the funny, my mother wanted to kill him. And he actually thought that he was paying her a compliment.
What'd your sister think?
She thought that he was like the sexiest thing on earth.
Wow.
She thought Anton was it.
I guess Anton didn't smell like the homeless person, though, who you based
him on. No, but my Uncle Gene did.
Really?
My Uncle Gene would come by my house, and my mother wouldn't let him in. We lived in the projects, and he would be outside the window screaming up, "Coolness! Don't have the key! I want to come up and steal your TV!" And there were, like, kids in the neighborhood. I would come home from school, and they say, "Yo, we got a bum." And they'd be, like, throwing rocks and stuff. And I'd look over and go, "That's my uncle."
How would you feel when you said, "That's my uncle"?
Well, I'd just pick up rocks and start throwing them. you can't disrupt the flow of the neighborhood.
Right. I mean, were you embarrassed by it or angry at your uncle for being
embarrassed? But I loved him. I had such an affection. I have an affection for characters, people who are who they are in
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, that's just amazing. You know, because everybody else is trying to put on a mask and be somebody different. But you know, a character like Anton or my Uncle Gene—they're just who they are, and they don't care.
Damon Wayans speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Damon Wayans. His HBO special, Damon Wayans, The Last Stand, is now out on DVD.
Now, you know, in addition to making up a lot of characters, back on the In Living Color era, you also did impressions of real people, such as Louis Farrakhan. And your impression of him was just really great. Describe what characteristics you were picking up on, like how you went about doing your version of Farrakhan.
My version of Farrakhan, I just love his passion,
mm-hmm.
you know, in his speeches, and I love the raspiness of his voice, you know, unlike, you know, the Baptist preachers, he doesn't, you know, he's more in control, you know, And he's so passionate, he can actually make black people stop celebrating Christmas if he wanted to, you know, just because he is so, you know, he knows how to give his version of the truth. You know, he's, Christmas is the devil's holiday. It started out back in slavery, where the white slave owner would dress up in a red sheet and climb down the chimney to the slave quarter. And like the devil he was, he wouldn't get burnt. That's why they call him Santa. If you take the N in Santa and put it at the end of Santa, you got Satan Claus. And that's what he is.
That's really great. Did you ever hear from Farrakhan?
When I did The Wrath of Khan, I saw his son, and he told me that the minister really liked it.
Well, that must have been a relief, right?
Yeah, I could have ended up in a bean pie somewhere.
Well, is it hard to do somebody like Farrakhan, who's such a controversial figure, and so many people are so passionate about him and might be very insulted that you were characterizing him?
No, I did it with deep respect. I wasn't making a fool of him.
Right.
I was just, actually showing the power he had on the Starship Enterprise and how he was able to make all these minorities see that Captain Kirk was a racist. That was the sketch. So it wasn't really on him. It was actually on Captain Kirk. William Shatner actually wants to fight me.
Now, I have to ask you about another character that you started on In Living Color and then kind of transformed a little bit and made the focus of your movie. And the character in Living Color was called Handyman, and he became Blank Man in the film. As Handyman, he was like a handicapped superhero.
I didn't do Handyman in Blank. Blank Man was a totally different character. I actually should have done Handyman the movie. You know, that was a bad character choice on my part. That's why the movie made about $6, because I didn't realize how much people liked Handyman, and Handyman would have been a lot more edgy than Blank Man. Blank Man, I played a virgin nerd. He had no handicap. He was just, you know, a geek.
And what about Blank Man? What was the handicapped superhero based on? I mean, Handyman.
Oh, Handyman?
Yeah.
What? I don't know. I was, in my stand-up, I was talking about how people look down on handicapped people and having a club foot. I understood it. And that, you know, handicapped people need to be loved the same as we do. And that they actually need some role models. And I think it would be wonderful if they had, you know, like a handicapped superhero named Handyman. And that's how it evolved.
And describe the character?
He's got palsy, but he believes in himself. And when he flies, he lands on top of people. Excuse me!
Now, you had a club foot when you were growing up, so you knew what it was like to have a handicap and probably to be mocked for it.
Oh, yeah. I got all my best fights came from people talking about my shoe. That was my weak spot. And, you know, we used to play this game called the Dozens.
Mm-hmm.
And people really didn't like playing with me because once they talked about my shoe, it was over. You know, we'd start out very friendly, you know, very kind of surface. You know, your mother wears combat boots. Yeah, well, your father is so poor he can't pay attention. Yeah, well, your sister is so ugly she got a top pork chop on her neck so the dog will play with her. Yeah, well, your mother is so black when she goes to night school they mark her absent. And then they go for the shoe. Yeah, so what about the crippled people shoes you be wearing? What about that, huh? Huh? Like, oh, so you want to get real now, huh? All righty.
Alrighty then, what about when your father left your mother with six kids? That's why two of your sisters have illegitimate children because there's no one there to guide them. That's why one of your brothers is a junkie, the other one is homosexual. That's why your sister outside prostituting because she can't afford to feed y'all. That's why every time welfare come over, y'all got to hide over my house because you kind of get two welfare checks when you're supposed to get one. Your turn.
So what did that shoe look like?
Like the Forrest Gump shoe. Remember Forrest Gump when he had that big shoe with the brace that went up to the knee? And it squeaked. That was the worst part of that shoe. The brace would make this noise. And you couldn't hide it. You know, I'm standing there talking to a girl and this shoe go, what's that noise? That's my shoe. It needs some oil.
So how old were you during the years you had to wear it?
My first pair of regular shoes I got when I graduated from high school. Not high school, into high school. From 9th grade into 10th grade.
So this means that during most of your school years, you couldn't wear real shoes. You couldn't run, which is probably pretty important.
I didn't play any sports.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't make orthopedic Nikes.
That's right.
They didn't have the Air Corky when I was growing up.
So did this, like, set you apart from everybody else?
Well, what it did was make me work on my comedy skills. Because I would be the guy sitting on the sideline trying to get attention, making people laugh, miss baskets, you know. And you know, that was the commentator. I would, you know, just had this running commentary on everything that was going on.
What about when you started being able to wear real shoes? Did that change your personality?
I actually lost my mind. I got thrown out of 3 different high schools because I was trying to be cool. You couldn't tell me nothing. I turned into Mac Daddy. I'm serious. I didn't even finish the 10th grade.
Wow. That was pretty quick, huh?
Yeah. But my shoes were great. If they graded me on my shoes, I'd have been on the honor roll.
What kind of shoes did you buy when you were able to choose them?
I have a closet full of shoes. I probably have over 100 pair of shoes.
Now, your brother Keenan was the first in the family to perform. What impact did it have on you to see your brother on stage?
That was some of the greatest moments of my life, was going out and watching Keenan go on stage at the Improv, because Richard Pryor used to perform there, and you know, Keenan would go up and I would tell him, Keenan, try this, and he would try it and it would get a laugh, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. You can think of something right there and go on stage and people would respond immediately to it, and I was in awe of Keenan.
So did that make you think that you wanted to try it too?
No, I was afraid. I mean, you know, Keenan was the guy who knew kung fu. You know, I was like, I could never do that. I don't have the gi.
He didn't perform in a gi, did he?
No.
I mean, you didn't think you'd have to fight your audience, did you?
No, I just felt Keenan was more disciplined. And Keenan knew what he wanted to be when he was about 7 years old. He wanted to be a comedian. He wanted to be like Richard Pryor. My mother used to call him the skinny man. And he just thought that Richard was like the funniest thing in the world. And he would, you know, if he was a Mike Douglas or Ed Sullivan or, you know, Johnny Carson, Keenan knew every time Richard was on. And he just, that's what he wanted to be.
So how did you start performing?
My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, got tired of me talking about Keenan. And she said, if you keep talking about Keenan, I'm going to go sleep with Keenan. So why don't you go on stage and do what he does, because you're just as funny?
Did you believe that? Not that you would sleep with Keenan, but that you were just as funny.
I think so. You know, I always knew I was funny. I just didn't know if I had the confidence or whatever it takes to get on stage in front of other people and do it.
What was that first time like?
It was the most bizarre experience in the world. I went on stage, and this is in New York, this place called Good Times, which was on First Street and Third Avenue. It's closed now, but it was like an open mic night, and I waited for like 6 hours to go on stage, and I wrote out all my jokes on a piece of paper, and I went up on it was the middle of winter, and it was freezing inside the club, mm-hmm. and I went up on stage, and my first joke that I ever told was, I come from a poor family. We were so poor, my father drove a 1974 big wheel. And I told that joke, and the audience laughed. And then I got so cocky, I folded up the paper and I put it in my jacket. And then I took my jacket off because I was sweating. I mean, it was freezing in the club, but I was so nervous that I broke out in this sweat. And I threw my jacket across the stage. And then I remembered that my jokes were in my pocket. And I just went blank for about 5 minutes, which felt like 5 hours. But all I remembered when I came off stage was that laugh that I got for the big wheel joke. And I was addicted.
Damon Wayans speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Damon Wayans. His HBO special, Damon Wayans, The Last Stand, is now out on DVD.
Your parents, you have like 10 kids in the family, and what, 5 of them are performers, 4 of them? The kids in your parents' family, I don't know what the others are doing, the ones who haven't been in performance, but it's a pretty, pretty darn good track record. Do you think your parents did things that led them to have so many talented kids?
Yeah. What they did was have 10 kids in a 3-bedroom apartment. We had to sleep in a bed. I slept with my brothers with their feet in my face, and they would, fart in my face and make me smell it while I was sleeping, and they would beat me up, and, those kind of things make you funny. You become a fighter, and the fact that my parents always encouraged us to get along, to have fun together, because my mother was so afraid for us. My father was very strict, so we couldn't go outside. We didn't hang out with all the other guys. I had a 6 o'clock curfew, even when I went through my, bad stage where I was like actually robbing people. I was tough until about 5:58. Then I had to go home.
Well, what would your parents do to you if you disobeyed them?
My father would beat you like a slave. My father used to make us get undressed and lay across the bed, and he'd beat us with a belt. So you didn't want daddy mad, because daddy was like venting. He would come home looking to spank somebody after a hard day's work. All right, who was bad? Because I need to unwind.
Now, in your brother Keenan's movie, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, the mother of the hero that Keenan plays is kind of omniscient, and she's the one who's always coming to the rescue. Did that remind you of your real mother?
Yeah, my mother is just the most amazing woman on the planet. She was so in tune to her children, and she knew how to rescue them, not from anything bad, but from themselves. I remember one time, I think it says in the book, I got suspended from school for feeling up this girl, like the school whore, and I happened to get caught because my shoe got stuck and I couldn't get away from the principal before he showed up. And so I got suspended and I had to bring my mother to school, and I didn't tell her what happened because I was so embarrassed. But she's sitting there in the dean's office with the principal, and he's going on and on and telling, you know, my mother how disgusting my behavior was and making this girl out to be innocent, and, you know, and this kind of behavior is disgusting, and he's like the next Jeffrey Dahmer. And in the middle of this, my mother looks over at me, and I could feel her looking. I thought she was going to hit me. I had my head down, and she said, "Look, don't waste my time with this BS. I can't help it if my son is a lover." And I fell in love with my mother right there. I was like, a lover? It gave me such a sense of confidence. I looked at the teacher like, "Yeah, don't be wasting her time with this BS. I got loving to do." When I got outside the classroom, she smacked me upside my head and told me, "Boy, if you ever do that again, I will break you in half." So, you know, she knew right then and there I needed that.
Now, why didn't she respect the principal or the teacher when they were criticizing you? Why did she kind of show them up and then criticize you afterwards?
Well, I think she knew, especially because of my shoe, and if I didn't get, you know, in touch with my sexuality at that moment, you know, who knows what I've been. I was a very introverted kid. I was very mischievous, but I was also, you know, very shy. And, you know, she knew that if I didn't feel a breast and one soon, you know, who knows what I would have turned into.
Damon Wayans speaking with Terry Gross. His HBO stand-up special, Damon Wayans' The Last Stand, is now out on DVD. And he'll appear in the new Showtime series, The Underground. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Glass Books of the Dream Eaters, a debut novel of excitement, danger, and intrigue by playwright Gordon Dahlquist. From the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. And from Jim and Karen Frank. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, me and a guy named Elvis. Jerry Schilling was just 12 years old when he first encountered a teenage Elvis Presley in a touch football game. The two became close friends as Presley's career took off. Schilling's new memoir chronicles his years as part of the Memphis Mafia on tour with the King. Join us for the next Fresh Air.